From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, it's time for Eastern Standard. I'm John Hingsbergen. Our show is normally live and interactive on these Thursday mornings, but I hope you'll forgive us if we veer off course a bit in a way that I hope you will enjoy. We have two very interesting interviews for you, including a conversation with the great Ricky Skaggs. He released an autobiography this past summer, Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. We'll get to Ricky later in the show, but first, the man behind StoryCorps. It's a feature we've heard on Morning Edition for over 10 years. In honor of its 10th anniversary, David Isay has put together the fourth book based on the radio series. This one is Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. David Isay spoke with me from NPR's studios in New York City.
10 years ago, I had this kind of crazy idea and put a booth in Grand Central Terminal where you can bring anybody you want to honor by listening to their story. So it could be a parent, a grandparent, a friend. You come to this booth. You're met by a facilitator who works for StoryCorps, brings you inside, and you sit across from, say, your grandmother for 40 minutes. Facilitator's in the corner. Lights are low in this completely silent little room in front of two microphones, and you talk. And in many ways, StoryCorps, the method of StoryCorps is a way to distill your life as best that's possible in 40 minutes in a conversation. At the end of the 40, so they're very often very profound, very emotional conversations. At the end of the 40 minutes, two CDs have been burned. One goes home with you. The other stays with us and goes to the Library of Congress. So your great, 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 great grandkids can get to know your grandmother through her voice and story. So a very simple idea. I had been a radio producer for many, many years for public radio before that, and had a sense that giving people the opportunity to have these conversations with a microphone, which gives you permission to ask questions and talk about things you don't normally get to talk about, could be very meaningful in people's lives. And that being listened to for everyday people and becoming part of American history reminds folks, especially those who feel least heard in our society, that their lives matter and that their lives are important. So that was 10 years ago, and it's been an incredible ride. We've now recorded about 50,000 interviews, more than 50,000 interviews with close to 100,000 people in all 50 states. I think it's about 1,500 cities and towns that we visited. And we're going to keep going. We're working hard to turn StoryCorps into a sustaining national institution that reminds us all of those things that are so core to, you know, what we all try to do in public broadcasting, reminding people of the importance of listening and the fact that if we take time more, a little more time to listen to each other and less time, spend a little less time yelling at each other, we'd be a better, stronger country.
There are a couple of fixed locations where people can come to record the stories, but are you still traveling?
Oh, yeah. Yes, and I know we were in Kentucky just a couple of years ago. No, we're traveling booths all over the country and recording thousands of interviews a year and, you know, trying to give as many people as possible the opportunity to participate. But, you know, at this point, when StoryCorps started, people really didn't understand quite what we were trying to do. So we had empty slots at the beginning, and today we have no empty slots. It's a struggle, a big struggle to try and meet the demand to participate in StoryCorps.
StoryCorps is still airing on Friday mornings on Morning Edition?
That's right.
Has that any of that changed in terms of frequency of broadcast? Are we hearing fewer StoryCorps stories than we once did? Will we hear them more and in other places beyond that once-a-week broadcast?
Well, we're about to have our 500th week in a row on Morning Edition on Friday mornings, and we're going to continue doing that. We also do some special projects on the weekends on public radio. But yeah, I mean, we are trying to get StoryCorps content out far and wide. We have animations that we've started doing that air on PBS and get millions of views on the internet. You can find those at StoryCorps.org. And they are these really extraordinarily animated stories of the stories you hear on the radio. And of course, we've done books. Our fourth StoryCorps book, our 10th anniversary book, is just out. And it's called Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. And these are, you know, dozens of the most remarkable and electric stories that have been told in the StoryCorps booth about the connections we have with those people who are most important in our lives, people who have saved us, people who have rescued us. Mother Teresa used to say, you know, we've forgotten that we belong to each other. And this 10th anniversary book, I hope, helps us just a little bit, helps us to remember.
How have the books gone over? The stories are obviously told for audio, for radio, and very meaningful, make a strong impact when people hear these stories told. But can you really get that same sense from reading them on a page?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, John, as you probably can imagine, doing just transcribing a radio story does not a book make. It doesn't work. So what we do when we do these books is we go back to the original interviews. Remember, each story you hear on the radio is 3 minutes from a 40-minute interview. We go back in our archive of 50,000 interviews, put the voices out of our heads, get transcripts of those interviews that are appropriate, and then edit the transcripts so that, you know, I think in many ways each of these stories is kind of a poem, you know, both on the radio and on the page. I'm a radio freak. I mean, I've been in public radio my entire adult life, from the minute I graduated from college. And there's nothing better than the human voice, but it's also ephemeral, you know, and there's something wonderful about having the book in your hand, something that you go back and read again and see the pictures of the people who are participating. So I think of the books and the radio and also the animations as being complementary, all of which hopefully get out the messages of StoryCorps that we were just talking about. And you know, when you listen to these stories or read them or watch the animation, we hope that just for a moment you're going to be walking in the footsteps of someone who you thought was very different than you. And in that moment of listening to an authentic story told, in a way, it's the opposite of reality TV. You know, no one comes to StoryCorps to get rich. No one comes to get famous. It's simply an act of generosity and love. And when you hear these stories being told, for no other reason than out of love, that you recognize a little bit of yourself in the people who you're reading or listening to or watching, and realize that you may have more in common with this person than you thought you did.
When you started StoryCorps 10 years ago, you and your team certainly started with a lot of enthusiasm and excitement.
Yes.
What keeps you so enthusiastic today, 10 years later?
I'm way more enthusiastic now than I was 10 years ago. You know, if StoryCorps changed me in one way over the last 10 years, it's made me much more hopeful. And, you know, over and over again, hearing these stories, getting emails every day from people saying that the 40 minutes they spent in the booth was among the most important 40 minutes they've ever spent in their lives. You know, seeing the insanity in Washington and realizing that that is not representative of the country, of who we are, of who our neighbors are and our families are, and that there are these countless stories of grace and poetry and kindness, you know, and these examples of what America really is and how life can be lived to its fullest. And seeing that people keep coming and seeing the impact both listening and reading and participating in StoryCorps has had on people's lives is incredibly invigorating. You know, I mean, working in public broadcasting, when you get up in the morning and can look in the mirror and realize that everything you're going to do that day is going to make people's lives a little bit better. It's a remarkable feeling, and I feel very blessed and privileged to be able to do this work.
How do the stories vary state to state, region to region? Are there themes that you find in the southern states versus the Northeast versus the West Coast?
You know, the accents change and the kind of work people do changes depending on where you're going. But what people talk about, no matter where you are in the country, is exactly the same. And it's those, because again, StoryCorps is distilling people's lives down into what's important. And what's important are our families, our parents, our kids, the people who mean something in our lives, you know. And those are the stories that you hear over and over and over and over and over again wherever you go. Now, the kind of variations of the theme that emerge from that, as you know from listening to StoryCorps, if you've read any of these books, that's endless. The way that people riff on those subjects, but everything always goes back to those great themes of human existence.
Every year, the last number of years, you've been encouraging people to do their own StoryCorps project, as it were, around Thanksgiving. Is that still something you're encouraging?
Yes. So on the day after Thanksgiving, we have something called the National Day of Listening. And we ask people to take an hour out and take a break from shopping on Black Friday and record an interview with a loved one, kind of do it yourself, as the least expensive, one of the least expensive, or I guess the least expensive because it doesn't cost anything, but one of the most meaningful gifts that you can give to a loved one. We can't accept those interviews for the collection at the Library of Congress. There are very stringent rules about the quality of the recordings and the kind of releases that need to be signed. But the point is to have these conversations with a loved one and to, you know, take an hour to listen to them and ask who they are and how they want to be remembered and what's been important in their lives as a really powerful way of saying how much they mean to you.
Listeners are interested in telling their story and making their story part of StoryCorps. How do you advise they proceed to be part of the regular process of story gathering?
Well, the closest we have a booth in Atlanta and we have a booth in Chicago. That would be the closest to you all. And also, you know, ask the station to ask StoryCorps to come back down and we'll come and visit again or, you know, come to one of our booths wherever they are and bring a loved one. And if again, even if you can't participate in StoryCorps directly, you know, have these conversations, burn a CD, put it in a safety deposit box. Just make sure that you have those conversations now.
It's been 10 years. How much longer can StoryCorps continue?
We want to go on. You know, when StoryCorps began as a 10-year project, we were supposed to be winding down now. And a year into the project, I saw the power of this thing and decided to spend the rest of my life building this into a national institution that we hope will one day move the needle in this country on, you know, getting people to listen better to each other and treat one another with more compassion and recognizing the value in every life. So we hope that we're going to be around as long as these recordings are going to be around. And that's our plan, and that's what we're going to fight with every breath we have to make happen.
David Isay is founder and president of StoryCorps. David, thanks for being with us, and thanks for what you've done to collect these stories and continuing to do.
Thanks, John. It's a privilege. Thank you. Happy holidays.
The book is Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps, published by Penguin Press. Coming up, a Kentucky native who made a name for himself in bluegrass and country music, Ricky Skaggs, talks with us about his life and his music on Eastern Standard. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen. And for the rest of this hour, Ricky Skaggs, the Kentucky native and Grammy Award winner, was in Lexington earlier this year as part of his nationwide book tour for Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. I had the great pleasure of sitting down with Ricky Skaggs the night he spoke and signed books at Joseph Beth Booksellers.
Let's talk a little bit about the book, which I know is the reason you're making yourself available in a nationwide book tour. Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. Is this a memoir?
It definitely is a memoir. An autobiography, but, you know, and I don't really know the difference in the two, but certainly this pretty much chronicles my life, and not just in, you know, well, this happened this day, this happened on March, and this happened then in June. And I mean, it's not that kind of chronicling, but certainly I love the way the book starts. It starts pretty much at 6 years old. We go to see Bill Monroe in Martha, Kentucky, a little high school there that he came to. And just the story of that and how really I love the way the editors put it together, because really that show that night in front of that audience, but also playing in his band and his music, those are all the things that you know that this book's about. It's about Kentucky. It's about Eastern Kentucky, not just Kentucky, but the mountains of Kentucky, the culture of Kentucky, the music of Kentucky, the faith part of Kentucky. And, you know, playing with him was the first time I'd ever actually played with a real band before. It's normally just me and my dad and my mom would sing. And that was in church, or there was a little grocery store there in Blaine, Kentucky, called Butler's Grocery Store. And that's about the most I'd really played, because Dad had bought me a mandolin when I was five, kind of in the winter of my fifth year of life. And so when we went to see Mr. Monroe, it was probably this spring or summer. So I probably hadn't been playing more than about 6 months. You know, I knew some chords, and I wasn't playing a lot of solos or anything back then, but I was using it as an instrument to sing to.
And you knew a song called Ruby?
I did. I knew a song called Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man? And, you know, I knew some gospel songs with Mom, but she usually sung, and then I would sing harmony. So as songs that I could sing lead on, it was that song or a song called the Pinball Machine, you know. And so I think Mom did not really want me singing the Pinball Machine in front of those people.
Well, let's back up just a little bit. I mean, how clear is your recollection of that? I don't think all of us remember too much about what we were doing when we were 5 or 6 years old.
I really remember it.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
It would make an impression.
I remember, you know, flashes going off. I'd never seen that in church before, you know, where people were taking the cameras out and flashing, you know, and all that. So I remember that, and I remember the feeling of playing with a band, you know, and how that felt.
Back up in terms of how that happened. Bill Monroe was in town. Mm-hmm. Your dad, who was a musician and a big fan, mm-hmm. took you to the show.
Right.
And
not knowing that we would have a chance to even
play
with
him. You
had
been playing the mandolin.
Right.
And you were really brought on stage by acclaim, by the townsfolk, the people who knew you.
I call them the neighbors in the hood, yeah. They had seen me at church, and they'd seen me at the grocery store probably. And so I don't know if they were wanting to show off their little, you know, Hobart and Dorothy's, you know, the community picker kid. Or did they just want to, you know, have me get up there and sing something, you know. I don't know what brought all of it on, but I do know that they started requesting to let little Ricky Skaggs get up and sing. And I think Mr. Monroe kind of passed, passed on it there for a few times. But after a while, I think he was ready to get it over with, probably. And then being an entertainer, I would want to get that over with pretty soon and then get back to my show, you know. And so that's what he did.
During your career and the rise to fame over the years and your interactions with Bill Monroe, what had he to say about that in later years?
I saw him. I didn't actually see him anymore till almost 10 years after that. I was 15 when I saw him the next time. And I was working with Ralph Stanley, part of his Clinch Mountain Boys band, me and Keith Whitley, another Eastern Kentucky boy that I had met, and he and I had started singing some together. And we went to see Ralph Stanley, and Ralph's bus broke down, and he couldn't get there, so the club owner asked if me and Keith would get up and sing. My dad had taken us to see Ralph. And so we all got up and started singing music, you know, and all, the only the songs we knew was kind of Stanley Brothers songs. And so Ralph comes walking in and kind of discovers us on stage playing and singing his music. And that led to more shows. But we were still going to school and still in school. But we took off and went to Columbus, Ohio, and we actually saw Mr. Monroe. He was there at the show that Ralph was playing at, and I went up to him and asked him. I said, "Mr. Monroe, I'm Ricky Skaggs." I said, "I remember, you know, you asked me up on stage with you when I was 6 years old." I said, "Do you remember that?" And he said, "Well, it seemed like I remember a little boy coming up on stage." But he said, "I thought you was 12 or 13, wasn't you?" And I said, "No, sir, I wasn't. I was 6 years old." He said, "Well, I don't believe I'd have let a 6 year old get on stage with me." And I said, "Well, you did." So, and we have witnesses to that effect.
Well, you were grown up, you were brought up with music in the household, and this is in Lawrence County, Brushy Creek. Is that the
uh-huh.
hollow
yep.
where
right.
you,
yep.
I guess you grew up and
yep.
you started out?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? I mean, there was just music there? Dad and the family were always playing music?
Well, there was, you know, there was music around our house a lot, you know. Dad was a welder, and but he loved music. Mother always had the radio on. You know, she was always listening to George Jones or, you know, Bill Monroe or Flatt and Scruggs or Stanley Brothers or somebody. There was quite a few stations there in Eastern Kentucky, Grayson being one, WGOH in Grayson. And she would listen to WTCR in Ashland. And there was music all the time. And but Mother, whether the radio was on or not, Mother would be singing. She loved music. She loved to sing, and she was a really, really good singer. Just an old mountain woman, had a mountain voice, and very, very, I mean, it was pure as could be, but she sang. When she started to sing, you could hear her sing. I mean, she wasn't no soft singer. She sung hard, you know, and but she was noticing me singing harmony to her in the other end of the house. That's when I was about 3 years old, and so telling my dad, you know, I heard Ricky singing harmony to me, you know. This week he was in there working, playing with his toys, and I was singing, and he just, you know, started singing harmony, and it was a natural thing, and I was just doing what I had heard her do with Dad when her and Dad would sing. So I think that is what really prompted my dad to get me a mandolin, because he had a brother that got killed in World War II, my dad's brother, and my uncle played mandolin with Dad, you know, and so when he got killed, you know, it just shot a hole in my dad's heart too, you know, and I think Dad made one of those kind of inner vows that if he ever had a son or daughter that showed musical, you know, abilities, that he would get them a mandolin, and hopefully they'd learn to play and sing.
You were coming up in the late 50s, early 60s, mm-hmm. In the mountains, in the hollers,
yep.
of Eastern Kentucky. What about those communities was so special that caused music to rise up out of those communities? I suspect the same thing was not happening necessarily in the cities of Cincinnati or Louisville or Columbus.
As well. I don't think so. I think we lived so far back in the woods. I used to tell people that we didn't get the Grand Ole Opry till Wednesday night, you know. But now they have Monday and Tuesday night operas, you know. So that shot me down there now. But, you know, music was an escape valve. It was a letting off of steam, maybe. I don't know if that's the right word to use. But it certainly was a way to relieve pain and relieve tension through music. Now, some people would take it, you know, and add alcohol to it, you know, and that was their relief valve. But my mom and dad sang for pleasure. They sung for joy, and when they went to church, they sang as worship. I mean, it was just part of that experience, part of that lifestyle, you know. So I was surrounded by faith, family, community, and music, and you know, here again, no one was making money doing it. You know, that never was a factor to me getting into it. Although, as a young kid, Dad would take me to talent shows, and I remember winning 50 silver dollars one time. As the grand prize, and I kept those silver dollars for a long, long time. I don't know where. I wish I had them now. My goodness, you know, they would be, you know, and they were pure silver too. They weren't cut with something, you know. They were as amazing. But I don't know, you know. And I remember getting a transistor radio one time as a prize. And so I guess, you know, I guess there was a little bit of the financial thought in there. But it still, I mean, and it was nice to get paid for, you know, to make a little money doing something. But the whole time in my life, I mean, I grew up, you know, Ralph Stanley was the first job I ever really got paid to as a player, you know. So, and that was at 15, you know. So we did it, you know, we did it because we loved it, and we did it because it was part of the culture of the mountains. There's so many people in the mountains that played. It was that Scots-Irish thing, I think, that our family certainly, had in our families. My mother was a Thompson, and that's very very Scottish. And my dad, you know, being a Skaggs, we came from Ireland, you know, and came up. One of the brothers came into, I guess, the old family came over into South Carolina and then into North Carolina, and then kind of kept moving westward all the time. And my ancestors were long hunters that was in this country here, you know, in the Lexington area. There was Skaggs Trace that, you know, historically had more people than the Wilderness Trail, because Wilderness Trail just stopped at Boonesboro. And Skaggs Trace went on from Hazel Patch up to Harrodsburg, and then went on into toward Louisville, and took people, you know, up to the falls, you know, to the river up there. So I've got an old ancestry here, in, you know, in Kentucky, and makes me very proud to be from here.
As we talk about life in the mountain communities of Eastern Kentucky and music in the household and so forth, television, for instance, was fairly late arrival, and I guess a bit of a surprise in the lives of many people. Talk about your first appearance on television, and I guess it was your grandmother and her reaction. Of course, your reaction is interesting enough.
Yeah, my reaction was really weird, but television was a pretty new thing to mountain people. I mean, I guess television maybe had been around since I guess the late 40s, early 50s, something like that. But we just didn't really have a whole lot of television shows and programming. We could really only get WSAZ in Huntington, Channel 3. That's about the most we could get, was NBC. So we were watching that and snow on Channel 13 and Channel 8, you know. So But we didn't sit in front of the television all day long. Mom, you know, we had certain shows that we were all going to sit down as a family and watch Bonanza and a few things like that, you know, at night. But we just didn't, you know. I know Porter Wagoner had a show on, the Flat and Scruggs had a show on, and I remember in particular when we moved to Goodlettsville, Tennessee, which is just a little suburb of Nashville, and I was backstage one night at the Ryman Auditorium. Back, that's when the Grand Ole Opry was being broadcast from the Ryman. We were backstage and met Earl Scruggs, and I was standing there playing my mandolin and singing, and Earl came up and talked to my dad and said, why don't you bring that boy down for an audition for our television show next week? And so we made a time to go and went down and did the audition. I made the audition, and they set up a time, you know, a few weeks later for me to come and be a guest on the show. And I remember, you know, they sent us a card, you know, when the show was going to be broadcast. They sent a little, you know, 4x6 card or something in the mail from WSM, said, hey, the show you're on is going to be on, you know, this certain night and all that. So Mom, you know, we got home from school. Mom had dinner basically set on the table as soon as we got in. And I remember Dad came home early from work so we could all sit there and watch it together. And so I'm sitting there, and we're watching probably, you know, two or three songs that Flat and Scruggs do. You know, they go to commercial and come back. And when they came back from commercial, Lester Flat had it made up. He wanted me to come out and while he was talking on the microphone, he wanted me to come up and kind of interrupt him, you know, which was the biggest no-no in the world for my mom. You know, she did not like that at all.
Not the manners you were raised.
That was not the manners, no. Don't you ever interrupt somebody when they're talking, you know, especially an older person, you know. And you know, I didn't have Lester had come up to me during the commercial and said and told me all this, you know, said, I want to find a way to get you out there on the stage, you know. So he had it made up, and well, I didn't have time to give Mom the memo, you know. And so she, you know, knowing that she's sitting in the audience, you know, me having to go out there and interrupt him, you know, that was hard enough. But when we were sitting there watching the show, and I saw myself walk out on the set, you know, on the television show, it freaked me out. I mean, I was so shy, but I must have thought in my mind that these people were there live all the time. You know, I didn't know about videotape. I didn't know that you can actually tape something and put it on tape. And, you know, I mean, a 7-year-old mind hadn't just – I hadn't gone there. I hadn't thought that, you know. And so to see myself walk out there and see my flesh and bones being right here, it was kind of a freak out, you know.
This was black and white.
This was black and white, yeah. And so I ran into to my bedroom and got under my bed, you know. I really did. It was a freaky thing. But I, you know, I never watched what I did. I heard it, but I never saw it.
We'll have more with Ricky Skaggs on this special holiday edition of Eastern Standard. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. In this special holiday edition of our show, we're continuing our conversation with Kentucky's own Ricky Skaggs, discussing his life and his career as told in his autobiography, Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. Before we took a break, Ricky was telling us about his first appearance on TV, on the Grand Ole Opry, as a matter of fact. The show was videotaped, and when the show actually went on the air, with the family gathered around the black and white TV, Ricky says he couldn't handle it. He ran into his bedroom and hid under his bed.
I never watched what I did. I heard it, but I never saw it. And it was probably 35 years plus. It took me that long to be able to find a copy of that so that I could, you know, once I grew up and got some sense about myself, you know, and realized, oh, it's video, get over it, you know.
Sure.
But I actually sat down with my youngest two kids, Molly and Luke, and watched it with them. A friend had made a copy from a video and sent to me and said, hey, you're gonna love this, you got to watch it, you know. And I didn't know till it came on, there I was, you know. But
is
that's
it out there on YouTube now?
It's on YouTube. You can see the both songs, Ruby and Honky Tonk Swing was an instrumental. And I've got this Vacation Bible School haircut, not the Elijah look that I have right now. So anyway, it's for all to see, you know, 7 years old. And my grandmother, my dear precious, my great-grandmother, she was living in up in eastern Kentucky, up in around Cordell there. And the story goes, I wasn't there to see it, but she said when I came on the television set and they had my picture, you know, the, kind of a close up of me, she walked over to the television set and bent down and kissed it and patted it, thinking that I could feel it, you know. So us Skaggs bunch was a mountainous bunch, and
these were different times. People were learning what this technology was all about.
It sure was.
We certainly weren't exposed to it as we are today. Yeah. Now, your career developed. You ended up in the suburbs of Nashville, and your career centered around Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
You started with bluegrass and moved into country music.
I did.
And now you're back to bluegrass, as I understand it?
Yeah, in 19, you know, I had a great country music career. Started about 1980, 81. My first hit was in 81. That went through till about 1996. And when Bill Monroe passed away, and my dad passed away the same year, and I just kind of made a conscious decision that I was going to go back to the roots of the music. Although I had, with a lot of my country hits, they had bluegrass overtones. I mean, they had the bluegrass harmony structure. They had the mandolin, fiddle, banjo, guitar. They had all of that. All those elements were still in there. Like Highway 40 Blues was just full of bluegrass. Country Boy was full of bluegrass. A lot of the songs, Crying My Heart Out Over You, Don't Cheat in Our Hometown, Wouldn't Change You If I Could, all of those songs, Uncle Penn, those were all originally bluegrass songs, just done in a little different fashion, you know. And but, yeah, I decided to come back because I felt like that bluegrass lost a leader with Mr. Monroe. And I didn't come back to take his place, certainly. No one could ever take his place. But I felt like he would want me to come back and really play the music of my youth, the music that was the foundations of everything that I stood on. And I think it would have pleased him to know that I had come back to play it and to try to, you know, try to raise up other young people and to encourage them to hear this music, that this music is cool, it's great, it's very, you know, it's cultural, but it is it's a genre that you know, really deserves the honor and respect that that it was created for.
Would you say that country music evolved into something far beyond its roots in terms of
the
mixing and multi-tracking?
Yes.
And the orchestration.
Yes.
And the way it's produced today?
Absolutely.
And bluegrass is certainly more
yeah,
pure and simple.
I think bluegrass is the most pure form of country music there is, you know. And you know, there's people that's playing, the Avett Brothers and Mumford & Son. They're playing roots music. They got banjo in the band, and they're playing this roots music. They just got a younger approach, and they got, you know, Mumford & Son has a kick drum on stage that they're kicking and beating all the time while they're playing this music, and it's just wild, just blown out bluegrass, or a form of bluegrass music, and kids are loving it everywhere.
And you're happy about that?
I'm
like
totally
that?
Happy with that. I think bluegrass needs to always evolve, but what I love about country, or love about bluegrass, is that we don't forget our root system. We don't forget the fathers. We don't forget Bill Monroe and Flatt & Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers. We still honor and respect them. Where country music, there's a lot of country artists now that grew up listening to, you know, to Lynyrd Skynyrd. They listened to Charlie Daniels. They listened, I mean, back when Charlie was doing, you know, all his you know, Southern rock music, you know, and that's okay. And a lot of the young artists only came on after Garth Brooks kind of, you know, got very popular. So they're not going back necessarily to really research the George Jones, Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, Ray Price, Webb Pierce, you know, time period, you know. A lot of the girl singers are not really, you know, going back to Kitty Wells and you know, back to that era. And they're certainly not going back to the Carter family, which that was the original, kind of the original well root system there, you know, that inspired, you know, all of America through music.
When you talk about the Carter family, it makes me think of your Christian faith and the fact that you're very outspoken.
Yeah.
About your faith. Many musicians over the last couple of decades have been outspoken about issues.
Mm-hmm.
And their concerns, political issues.
Right.
And so forth. What do you think about artists getting involved in movements like that? I know Johnny Cash was apparently one of your heroes.
Yes, he
and
was.
You knew him well.
I did.
And he spoke out against the Vietnam War after.
Yeah.
He learned what was going on over.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
What about expressing yourself in that fashion and expressing an opinion in through your music?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, people can talk about politics or left-leaning issues, gay rights, they can stand up and talk about all of that, but, you know, people that, like myself, that stand up and talk about my faith as a Christian, we get crucified for something like that, you know, and it's a tough pill to swallow sometimes, but it doesn't make us not swallow it. You know, we continue to press on and be faithful to the call. But I think it's, to me, an artist you know, is you can't separate, you know, because my record label wanted me to separate my music from anything else that I did. And I said, I can't do that. I mean, that's like telling me I can only be a Christian on Sunday when I'm, you know. Now, what if I'm working on the road on Sunday? Am I supposed to, you know, which I did, you know, most of the time. Sure. I said, you know, the Christian life is a life, okay? It's an everyday life. It's a commitment. It's faith. It's what I believe in, you know. And it's not something that I can just take off and put on like a suit of clothes, you know. And so I got a lot of reprimand from, you know, from my label heads and label chiefs that didn't like, you know, the outspokenness, and maybe because there was a lot of the heads of the labels were Jewish, and maybe people under them were thinking that I was offending, you know, their faith by being outspoken as a Christian. I never ever said anything detrimental toward Jews at all. I love Jewish people. I mean, we're as Paul says, and you know, in the New Testament, that we're grafted in, that we're blessed to be grafted into the root system of the Jews, you know. And so as Christians, we should always, you know, honor the root system, always bless Israel, and Sharon and I do. We're very, very strong, very outspoken toward Israel, and you know, very pro Israeli, you know, people, you know, the Jewish people, and but probably the most hated people group in the world, and yet, you know, we still try to stand by.
You have a music career that's now almost 50 years old, I guess we could say, because mm-hmm. of your very early start.
Yeah.
You've written what is an autobiography, or some could call a memoir. Where to from here? What are you doing right now? You understand you're doing some new recording now?
Bruce Hornsby and I have a new CD that was just released last week called Cluck Old Hen, and it's a live CD. If folks have never seen me and Bruce Hornsby live, that you ought to see that. You know, there's no hope, or there's no guarantee that we'll get to do this again. I mean, you just never know that when things change musically, and things change personally. I mean, we hope we can play, you know, for years to come, but you just never know. I mean, we have a real purpose to go out and do a tour again. We have this new record out. But it's one of the most incredible musical experiences for 2 hours to be able to see him playing bluegrass music at just breakneck speed, and then for my band and me, Kentucky Thunder, to be able to travel with him on his Bruce Hornsby music, things like The Way It Is and White Wheel Limousine and The Dreaded Spoon, Mandolin Rain, all those things that made him, you know, famous. It's just an incredible journey. It's a musical journey, really, is what it is, for 2 hours on the road. So we have that. That's our current thing right now. Sharon and I, my wife Sharon, of 32 years now, we're finally getting around to doing a duet project. We were Duo of the Year by the CMA in 1987 with Love Can't Ever Get Better Than This. And we've recut that song, and we've got 5 songs cut right now, and we plan to do the rest of the record and have it out sometime in 2014.
Excellent. So, and you're gonna keep on, right?
I'm way too young to quit. You know, I got a lot of more music to make. I mean, there's ideas that I have floating around in this old gray-haired noggin, so I want to do more things. I'd love to do it would take some backing and some financial, certainly some financial backing, but because the Boston Pops are a very expensive orchestra to, you know, to work with, but I would love to do a whole CD, you know, with them. They're the best string players, orchestra-wise, that I've heard. And, of course, Keith Lockhart is just a brilliant conductor and loves bluegrass, loves what we do. We've done two or three different shows with them in Boston. They also go out to Tanglewood and different places in the summertime and do outdoor summer series. But I would love to do a project, whether it's with the Boston Pops or not, but I would love to do a string orchestrated bluegrass project. If you've never seen something like that, you would not believe how wonderful the timbres of the music, how the instruments, how they work so well together.
They're the same instruments.
They're the same instruments. They really, really are. But to hear classical music played and orchestrated, written out, and everybody pulling the same way, and then hearing my fiddle player Andy Leftwich just ripping through a solo off the top of his head. He ain't reading anything. He's just playing. And these people, you know, they would love to be able to look at him and see what he's doing, but they don't want to have to. They don't want to look off their chart because that's what they have to play. But it's really an amazing thing to hear bluegrass with an orchestra. So that's a project down the road that I'd really love to do, and certainly some other things.
That sounds exciting, and I hope you'll bring it to Kentucky, maybe even to Eastern Kentucky and the Center for the Arts,
or
one of the venues in this region.
Yes, we'd love it.
Ricky Skaggs, thank you so much for taking time to visit with us and our listeners in Eastern and Central Kentucky.
Thank you very, very much for having me on.
Ricky Skaggs' autobiography is Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music, published by It Books. By the way, we're hearing music from Ricky's album in collaboration with Bruce Hornsby, Cluck Ole Hen.
Well, I had an old chicken. She wouldn't lay an egg. So I run hot water up and down her leg. Had a little chicken hollered. Little chicken begged. Danged old chicken laid a hard-boiled egg. I said, cluck old hen, cluck and sing. Ain't laid eggs since a whale last spring. Cluck old hen, cluck and squaw. Ain't laid eggs since a whale last fall. Sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes enough for the whole dang crew. Cluck old hen, cluck and sing. I ain't laid eggs since a whale last spring. Cluck old hen, cluck and squaw. I ain't laid eggs since a whale last fall.
Thanks to our guest, Ricky Skaggs, and earlier, David Isay, the creator of Public Radio's StoryCorps. Eastern Standard is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University. Our associate producers are Andrew Moorhead and Richard Turner. Our technical director is Jonice Franklin. A reminder, this show will be available online later today and will be able to be downloaded as a podcast. The show will repeat Sunday evening at 6 o'clock. We're interested in hearing from you anytime with your comments and topic or guest suggestions. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at WEKUEST. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm John Hingsbergen.